by the time this programme ends in half an hour's time, celebrations will have started in London to mark Brexit. It's going to be a difficult transition for the marine sector in Ireland, but the fishing sector in the UK sees it as an opportunity. Barry Dees is the chief executive of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations in the UK. He spoke to me earlier about Brexit and first told me about the fishing industry there.
It's a representative body for fishermen in England, Wales, Northern Ireland. Very diverse membership, from large vessels that fish in external waters down to single-handed vessels that fish for crab and lobster. We've got something less than 1,000 vessels these days after fleet contractions. At one time it was about 2,000 vessels. So that's us. We're the voice of the fishermen in England, Wales, Northern Ireland.
You say, and we've read over the years as well, how the British fleet has contracted, how small fishing towns along the British coast have got smaller and smaller, some are dying out.
Yes. No, although the bigger ports like Hull and Grimsby were very badly affected by the loss of the Icelandic fishing grounds, it was the common fisheries policy that has certainly been one of the drivers for the contraction of ports. I mean, if you look at the east coast of England, there's practically nothing there. There are a handful of vessels, really, by comparison with when I started working for the NFFO in 1985, when the common fisheries policy was just getting underway. So there is a strong feeling within the fishing community on that coast, but I think throughout the UK that the common fisheries policy has not been good for our fisheries.
What percentage of fish caught in British waters are caught by British trawlers?
Well, the estimate is something like 40% of the resources that are in UK waters are caught by the UK fleet. In other words, 60% are caught by non-UK vessels, principally EU vessels.
It is very significantly more than what Irish boats are allowed to catch in Irish waters.
Yeah. The other statistic is that EU vessels fish about six times as much in UK waters as UK vessels fish in EU waters. You can play around with that statistic. It's eight times if you're just talking about weight, and it's about five times if you talk about value. But a very significant discrepancy in however you calculate it.
You were very much in favour of Brexit.
Fishing industry was very much in favour of leaving the EU for the simple reason that it is an escape route from the common fisheries policy. And common fisheries policy in the UK has been a running sore right from the outset, from 1973, because of the terms of entry that provided equal access to all waters, which essentially meant access to UK waters. And we can't help but contrast that with those countries like Norway, Faroes, Iceland, that have had control over their fisheries as independent coastal states. And so when the referendum came along the referendum result, I think to many people, was a surprise, but it did open opportunities that weren't there before. And I think the fishing industry, the UK fishing industry as a whole, has seized that opportunity and wants to maximise it.
What will be your stance now over the next 11 months going into talks? And I hear that Michael Gove this morning has said that Britain will leave without a deal if there is no deal on fisheries.
The government on the BBC website, it also says that fishing is amongst the top five priorities, the only industry to get a specific listing in those terms. I think it's very important to understand the legal change. The UK, as it leaves the EU tonight, becomes an independent coastal state with all the rights and responsibilities under international law. So, in a sense, if things go wrong now, it's the UK government that has primary responsibility for it, because we have the right legal base now, which we didn't have within the common fisheries policy. So that's why I think the government is very keen to send signals at this stage that there will not be a sellout of fishing as there was in 1973. And so, yeah, I think a lot hangs on the government.
And what do you and the NFFO want?
We want what Norway has, which is, as an independent coastal state, the EU's current relationship with Norway is the ideal for us, because there's an annual cycle of negotiations, takes into account the most recent science. Also, quota shares are determined there. Access arrangements are agreed there too. And, you know, if there's no agreement at the end of the year, as sometimes happens between EU and Norway, then Norwegian fishermen don't get into EU waters and we don't get into their waters. At that time of year, we want to get into Norwegian waters for cod, they want to get into our waters for blue whiting. That's the model that's worked successfully for 40 years between EU and Norway. That's exactly what we want.
Where does that leave Irish fishermen, who at the moment the Irish fishing fleet takes 30% of all its catch from British waters?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that there will be a deal. There will be a deal on fisheries that is separate from the broader deal. And the principal focus is on rebalancing those quotas. The UK and member states have different shares of different stocks. The most extreme ones for us are like in the Channel, Eastern Channel cod. The UK share is 9%. The French share is 84%. Or Celtic Sea haddock, the UK share is 10%, the French share is 66%. Those are the kind of things that we want to see redressed. So that there will be a direct link to access, I think, in the future. And we will see progressively a rebalancing of the quota share. So I don't think anybody realistically in the fishing industry thinks there's permanent exclusion of the Irish fleet or any other member state fleet from UK waters. But there will be, I think, a rebalancing of those quota shares.
And it's your understanding at the moment that the British government is behind you all the way?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, to make the statement that Michael Gove has made, the Prime Minister has made, that there's on the BBC website today, that we're amongst the top five priorities, indicates a very strong commitment to deliver on the promises that have been made to the UK fishing industry. And of course, we will hold them to that. I think also fishing is kind of emblematic of Brexit. A lot of the outcomes from the trade talks, etc., will take years, maybe decades, before we'll really understand the full consequence. But the fishing is very immediate, it's very visible, and we'll understand very quickly whether the fishing industry has got a good deal or a bad deal. I think that's why the government, the UK government, understands it needs to give priority to fishing this time.
And thanks to Barry Dees of the NFFO. All the political parties have published their manifestos at this stage, and we thought we'd take a look at what they have to say about the marine sector and the fishing sector. Lorna Siggins came in to me earlier. We went through what was on offer.
So Fine Gael has the advantage of being able to draw from the Harnessing Our Ocean Well strategy, which was initiated by former Marine Minister Simon Coveney when he was in that portfolio. And so they are able to draw on a lot of the aspirations in that strategy. So they're committing to this National Marine Planning Framework, which is all work is already underway on that. And they're saying that they will enact the Marine Planning and Development Management Bill, which also aims to replace the existing foreshore legislation. But as we know, the Department of Agriculture, Food and Marine, as currently constituted, has said that it doesn't want to have anything to do with that Marine Planning and Development Management Bill. So it doesn't really refer to that in its policy as how it's going to get around that. And it also talks about the potential of offshore wind in relation to 70% renewable generation by 2030. So it is fairly substantial. But as I say, if you compare it to Harnessing Our Ocean Wealth, you see that there's a lot that has been taken out of that.
But for a party who's been in government for an awful long time, it's very aspirational. Take, for example, they have a part on Ireland's first maritime national park and says, we'll investigate the practicalities of this.
It is very woolly, yeah. And then they talk about, you know, expanding marine protected areas and greater engagement and learning experience among Irish people for their maritime environment. But yes, you're right. A lot of it is very aspirational.
It's not telling fishermen or the industry that, look, lads, we're going to get your quotas increased.
No.
Let's go on then to Fianna Fáil. It's a much smaller section.
Yeah, it's smaller. I suppose it's short, but it's to the point. And I suppose from the fishing industry point of view, they're talking about setting up a Brexit contingency funding for fishermen and a fully funded European Maritime and Fisheries Fund post 2020. Now, I know Fine Gael has already said, yes, we're trying to Brexit-proof industries as well. Fianna Fáil talks about increasing the Marine Institute funding by 3 million to boost research. Reviewing the Sea Fisheries and Maritime Jurisdiction Act, which has been very controversial, introducing a fair penalty point system for fishermen that meets EU obligations. And it's also talking about introducing an Oceans Act to protect Ireland's seas while working at an EU level to achieve the establishment of ambitious 2030 targets.
It also talks about, and Fine Gael does as well, protecting traditional coastal fishing communities and banning very large trawlers from inshore fishing.
Yes, and this is something that Sinn Féin picks up on. Sinn Féin's one priority in marine is securing a ban on super trawlers with more effective controls and monitoring in the interim. It talks in its policy about super trawlers being highly destructive, contributing nothing to the Irish economy and having a history of illegal and unethical activities. Now, it doesn't quite spell that out, but it also says a Sinn Féin government will fight for an EU-level ban on super trawlers. Until that is achieved, we will work towards the strictest possible controls and monitoring of super trawlers. It doesn't give any length or, you know, it doesn't give any breakdown of the super trawlers and whether it's talking about EU and non-EU or anything like, none of that sort of detail. The thing that really jumps out of the Green Party marine policy is that it's talking about designating 50% of Irish territorial waters as marine protected areas to heed the advice of the ecologist E.O. Wilson that half of the natural world needs to be protected in this way. 50% of Irish territorial waters as marine protected areas is massive. And it's interesting because the Social Democrats said that the idea of 50% of Irish territorial waters as marine protected areas is completely unrealistic. Social Democrats are talking about a blue carbon strategy for identifying and protecting Ireland's blue carbon sites such as seagrass, kelp beds and salt marshes. Promoting and supporting the development of native oyster beds at suitable sites around the country, including Arklow. Strengthening and protecting small fishing communities, investing in tidal energy research and also working on implementing a ban on super trawlers in Irish waters.
I've just been speaking to Barry Dees of the NFFO in the UK. He believes that there will be a deal done on Brexit over the next year. What's the feeling in Ireland?
I think there's a lot of concern. I was speaking to Donald Kelly of Fast Fish down in Castletown Bear during the week. He was saying that the community is, the fishing industry is still very concerned. They really did feel they needed more reassurance as to fishing being part of trade talks. Now, the Taoiseach has given that reassurance this morning when he was interviewed on Morning Ireland, and he was talking about linking fishing to those trade talks and working to represent the coastal communities.
Lorna Siggins. Now, I have in my hand a new book, which is A History of Cork Harbour by Cal McCarthy. It traces in detail the history of the harbour from the 1700s. Its author is historian Cal McCarthy. He told me about the book.
The book is a modern history of Cork Harbour, I suppose a later modern history from about the time that the military began to transition their operation from Kinsale in the middle of the 18th century up to the end of World War I. So I suppose it goes through that time period, but it also takes in civilian operations in the harbour at the time. It's the combination of those two things, and each one of them affected the other, you know. So, you know, what the military did had to be approved by the civil authorities sometimes, and vice versa, and both had to develop the harbour in coordination and in cooperation with each other.
You recount how the Seven-Year War in the 1800s and then the American War of Independence developed the harbour.
From about the middle of the 18th century, Kinsale had been the British Navy's major base on the Western approaches, as they would call it. But from about the middle of the 18th century, they had some difficulties accessing Kinsale with some of their larger ships. And also, the continuous problems with French privateers, Spanish privateers, Dutch privateers raiding along the south and west coasts made the implementation of a convoy system necessary. That meant that you would build up huge convoys of ships before you sent them out into the Atlantic. Now, Kinsale was too small and, as I say, too shallow at times to build up those convoys. So they began to move all of that operation up towards Cork. And by the end of the 18th century, there are frequently enough convoys of several hundred ships lying in the harbour in Cork ready to sail into the Atlantic under the convoy of the Royal Navy, you know.
So during the War of Independence, then Cork was a major staging ground for troops being transported to what is now the US.
Yeah, it was the major supply depot, actually, more so than any of the bases in Britain. The ships would sail from Britain, most of them, into Cork, and supplies. But now many of the troops were boarded in Britain, some in Ireland as well at Cork, but all would build up this convoy in the Lower Harbour, and then the supplies from the agrarian hinterland were assembled and put on the ships down in Cork, and it became the major linchpin in the whole supply operation for the army in North America.
You then talk about how, because of the naval presence, the harbour became fortified, and those fortifications are still there today.
They are. The major era of fortification, like towards the end of the 18th century, you know, after the American War of Independence had made Cork Harbour such a major military base, the next major enemy on the horizon for the British were the French. And these convoys that were building up in Cork Harbour, even during the American Revolution, there was a considerable fear that these would be raided by French privateers or indeed even the French Navy. There was even a story from about 100 years later, so the truth of it is difficult to discern, but there was a story that they raided, a French privateer raided into the harbour, cut out several vessels, and later, because it had been crewed by locals, put up posters in the city of Cork bragging of their achievement in the Lower Harbour.
That it actually says, if you want to buy your goods back, come to a certain place and you can buy them back.
Exactly, yeah. So the fear of the French doing that, as I say, whether that story is true or not, it's difficult to discern. There may be some grain of truth in it. It may be entirely true. But what it tells you is that there was a considerable fear that the French would do this and that the harbour was fortified accordingly. And anyone who has sailed in or out of Cork Harbour or looked at it even from Great Island, from Cove, will see that nowadays there are three very visible major forts, Spike Island, Fort Camden and Fort Carlisle. And all three of them were built in, were their modern incarnations as you see them today anyway, were built in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and built in reaction to this fear of the French. Because if the French got into the harbour, it would be a major military defeat for the British Navy to have a convoy of several hundred vessels destroyed while they were lying at anchor in a harbour was obviously something that was unthinkable. That's why the forts were put there, you know.
Now, when they started developing this, parts of it weren't a natural harbour and go right up into the city. It needed an awful lot of work.
Yeah, Cork Harbour struggled always with its, the major urban centre is I think 13 miles even from Great Island, never mind Roches Point. They were continually dredging the river from the deep water at Passage up to the city and creating enormous construction projects like the new wall or the navigation wall in Cork, which was something actually that before I wrote the book I'd never paid much attention to. But, you know, for your listeners that might be familiar with the GAA, if they ever go down to Páirc Cliath, they'll see the river running down next to the stadium, obviously from the city. And all along that river, all the way down to Black Rock, this wall was built. That whole area was a marsh with several channels cutting through it. So they built this wall and they channeled the river into one channel in front of that wall.
By the time the wars with the French were over, Cork Harbour then became a prison.
Yeah, the convict history of Cork Harbour began in Elizabeth Fort here in Cork City. They left the convicts wait for the ships, sometimes for, I would say a good average would be about 6 months, because the ships had to be procured from private operators. And once the ship was in the lower harbour, they would ship them down from Elizabeth Fort and board them on the ship below. In 1822, they put a convict hulk in the harbour. Now, the hulk was the old decommissioned ship. We're, I suppose, familiar with images of convict hulks lying on the Thames and etc. There was only ever one hulk in Cork Harbour. There was another one in Dunleary. And those hulks were used for male convicts, whilst Elizabeth Fort was used for female convicts. Then in the 1840s, the hulks were decommissioned, Elizabeth Fort was closed, and the convicts' operation was moved back up to various Dublin jails until the 1840s, when it came south to Cork again.
Through famine times and subsequently, it became the main centre of emigration both to Australia and to the United States and North America. But World War One revived the harbour's fortunes again.
Well, first of all, when the war began, Cork Harbour was actually very quiet because, you know, as many of your listeners will know, the expected battle and indeed much of the naval operation did occur in the North Sea. So the British Navy deployed a lot of their vessels, including some of those who were initially stationed in Cork, in the North Sea. Now, the Cork Harbour came into play when submarines started to escape, if you like, from the North Sea and started to prey on shipping in the Atlantic and in the Irish Sea. So Cork Harbour then became a base for predominantly for anti-submarine operations. And in 1917, the Americans entered the war and they just deployed several destroyer squadrons into the lower harbour. And there was a huge military build-up in Cork Harbour of Americans and British at that stage.
And they weren't universally welcomed because there was great fear about the morality of the people of Cork with so many Americans there.
There was. This is something that I think John Borgenovo in UCC has written articles on, and they're cited in the book. I suppose, first of all, the Republican movement was gaining traction all over Ireland by the end of the war. You'd had the conscription crisis, and Sinn Féin were gaining followers throughout the country. So republicanism was becoming more popular. This war was becoming less popular. And then the Americans came, you know, were present in the harbour as well. And as is normal, they started to court Irish women. And this became a kind of a moral outrage for some in Irish society. And, you know, you even had things like Carrigrin and Wood on Little Island. Was
raided
closed.
By a priest.
Exactly, yeah. And closed then by the Harbour Commission who owned it because he had seen... Now, to be... I think what he described really were prostitutes from... Well, it was alleged the prostitutes couldn't possibly be Irish women. They must have been English women. And they were in company with American sailors in Carrigrin and Woods. And then even up in the city, the you know, girls that were walking out with American servicemen, there were a few violent incidents on the streets of Cork and in the railway station when the American servicemen came up to the city. It resulted even in the American servicemen. Curiously, actually, it was a British admiral that commanded the Americans in Cork Harbour. And he eventually stopped them coming up to the city.
You bring your history up until the end of World War One, but the harbour was a treaty port. That ended really, you know, with a whimper rather than a bang.
It did. The treaty ports, as you know, were returned given to the Irish state. And as I understand it, it's not covered in the book, but as I understand it, there was a considerable economic deficit after that happened because communities in the lower harbour in particular, but probably right up into Cork City and beyond, you know, there were traders that made some money out of the British military, and not everybody was happy to see them go, though doubtlessly many, many were, you know.
Not your first book, Cal.
It's not. This is number five, I think. And I had dealt with Cork Harbour previously in the convict era. I've written about Spike Island and a convict ship called Neva.
You're involved in history in your everyday life as well, in Clonakilty.
I am, yeah. I do some of the research for the Michael Collins House in Clonakilty, which I suppose brings me back to the revolutionary era. As I say, I had done Coming the Man in 10 years ago now. So I'm back into that kind of revolutionary history era again. And, you know, obviously in recent times, that whole thing has gained more coverage in the media because of proposed RIC commemorations, etc., you know.
And Cal McCarthy's book, Cork Harbour, is published by Merriam Press. You'll find it in all good bookshops. Referring back to a court case we covered on the programme last week, where two Dubliners were convicted of obstructing shipping in Dublin Port. The two men were sentenced to 3 months imprisonment each during the week. Seemed a pretty harsh sentence, but they've both been released on appeal.